Let me begin by summarizing last week. My claim was is that Kant's fundamental breakthrough between rationalism and empiricism is that each of these believed that knowledge could come from one faculty. In the case of rationalism, reason. In the case of empiricism, sense. And that Kant's first claim, which I think to be a breakthrough claim at least in modern philosophy, is that all thinking, that is all knowledge, I want to be careful, all knowledge requires both thinking and sense, both concepts and intuitions. And they have to be joined with one another, and they're joined with one another in what Kant calls a judgment. And that, just keeping with this formality for the moment, Kant wants to make use of the two-sidedness of thought, that it is both concepts without intuitions are empty, intuitions without concepts are blind. You'll say that, it should be a mantra, you say it before you go to sleep, when you get up in the morning, as you eat your meal, right? You shall put it upon your bedpost and on the wall. And it also, it turns out that you'll discover, at least I discovered in the 30 years, that anytime you hit a new topic, the new topic, you can do kind of variations on this. So, you know, you can do, you know, this can be, you know, sociology, this can be history, you know, so sociology without history is empty, sociology without history is blind, et cetera, et cetera. You just use it all over the place. It just turns out to be a generally powerful formula, right? Because this side is going to talk about form and what informs, what has form. It's going to speak to what is universal in knowledge, by which we mean, since we're talking about concepts, concepts are those things that hold of more than one object. That's what it is by definition to be a concept. That's a whole of more than one object. So this is the notion of universality. And equally here, we're going to have the notion of the idea of mental activity. So that we are agents. As knowers, we are agents. That's what Hume didn't understand. So that even when we're knowing, we're acting in the world. We're shaping and forming the world. And we'll see how we're shaping and forming. But unlike, and it's going to be a heavy thesis, right? Unlike the rationalists, for whom the ideas just build up, clear, distinct ideas, we really are going to say that knowing is a form of doing. It's going to be one of Kant's revolutionary thoughts, a way of, well, I'm going to say a way of world making. On this side, we're therefore going to have to talk about the contents of thought, and we'll sometimes talk about contents in terms of literally, Kant will use the word, the matter of thought is sense. You will equally want to say that intuitions are particulars. And that this is our passive, or often a better word for passive is receptive, relationship to the world. How the world imprints itself on us. How the world constrains us. How the world plays a role. That this side is on its own what allows for the a priori, and this side what allows for the posteriori. Okay, now Kant's second thought, I suggested, was that not only does knowing require thinking and sensing, concepts and intuitions, but the work of judgment is not a form of seeing. That for both Descartes, when he talks about clear and distinct ideas, he wants that that thought that you should have something, and he says, you know, you should get it so clear that you can hold it in one simple mental glance. Whatever the hell that means. Right? Well, at least with empiricism, when they say that, they have some idea that we receive sensory impressions, an impression of yellow, we have a yellow experience, and that's supposed to be, again, a scene, or having a sense impression. And Kant thinks that this idea of knowing as seeing is a mistake. And the notion of judgment is going to claim that bringing intuitions under concepts, that's what judgments do, and how they do it we'll get to. It's going to be a long, hard climb up Mount Everest, but well, Patton describes, he has a two-volume account of particular reason, and he says that Kant's transcendental deduction is equivalent to crossing, he says, the great Arabian desert. Maybe not climbing Everest, maybe crossing the desert. But anyway, the notion is that we have to put these together in a judgment, and therefore knowledge is, I'm going to say always for Kant, discursive. It's always an activity of thought and of putting things together, and therefore, to use the language that, say, Bob Brandon would say, that to know something is to know relations. That something is true means something else is true. That is, we can make inferences from it. If you believe X, then you must believe Y and Z. Right? So this notion of judgment and discursivity is going to be a way of talking about how knowledge forms logical and inferential and deductive chains of propositions and sentences that relate to one another. So that was my opening gambit. Any questions just about the opening gambit before we try to do something with the a posteriori, and all that stuff? Okay. So, in order to start getting this in motion, to start being able to work with this, we decided we needed a little bit of a technical vocabulary having to do with types of propositions, the status of those propositions, and our capacity to evaluate those propositions. So the first thing we have is the thought that propositions can be either necessary or contingent. And a proposition, I'm going to say, is necessarily true The word for, when we talk about necessity, possibility, and the like, the way philosophers call these modalities, it's the modality of a judgment, is whether it is necessary or actual or possible. Hence, modal logic. Modal logic is the analysis of the relationship between necessity and necessity. My entire, or a good deal of my PhD was actually on Kant's modal theory. Big mistake. Big mistake. So, what do we mean by necessity? What do we mean by necessity? Well, what's the definition of something being necessary? We're all philosophers. Anyway.
More than kinda?
More than kinda. So more than possible. But then more than kinda could be just actual. Right? So if this isn't kinda a cup of tea, it's an actual cup of tea. So that got us from possible to actual. How do we get to necessity? What do we need to say? Yep. But it could not be otherwise. All right, so one claim is that something is necessary means it could not have been false. Necessarily true means it could not have been false. What other ways can we talk about necessity?
Independent of experience.
That's a question about whether everything necessary is independent of experience. Kant would tend to agree with you. We're going to come to that when I discuss causality in a moment. But after all, some people have thought that there are bits of experience that can be necessary in some sense. So that can't be definitional of what we mean by necessary. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It has been determined and has no freedom of variation.
Ah, that's interesting. So something is necessary if caused. I guess what I want to say is something can be caused to be the case, but not necessarily true. So we have a gap here between two types of necessity, which I'm going to come back to later. We're going to have to distinguish between causal necessity, that's the sign for necessity, a little square, that's a square by the way, and that's the sign for possible, okay, modal logic. So whenever you see me scribbling that on the board, it's because I'm too lazy to write necessary. So there's causal necessity, and there's logical or propositional necessity. And right now I'm interested in logical. I mean, is it just a question whether there is such a thing as causal necessity, right? That's what Hume denies. Hume says there is no causal necessity. Kant's terrified that there is. But that's what we're trying to get at the moment. We want logically necessary. Yeah.
The converse leads to contradiction.
Ah, that will do. The converse, the opposite of it is either contradictory or we'd probably best say impossible. That is, we want to keep to a modal vocabulary, then we want to say that the opposite of P is impossible. What would Leibniz say about necessity? Especially if he had read Kripke.
True across all possible worlds.
True in all possible worlds. Right. So something is necessarily true if it holds in every possible world. Right? Because then just there's no possible world in which it could be false, and therefore it's necessarily true. Okay. We're going to see that Kant has a problem with logical necessity. That is, he wants to get a notion of necessity that's what I want to say. He wants to find a space between logical necessity and causal necessity. And we can call that, for the time being, we can call that epistemic or transcendental necessity, but don't worry about it. I'll come back to that. Okay, so the first thing Kant has is a modal vocabulary in which he has the notion of necessity and contingency. The second thing he has, we discovered last week, is the distinction between a priori and a posteriori. And again, in this case, something is a priori true if what? What allows something to be a priori true?
It's necessary through thoughts or through concepts. Not
okay, so it's something that's going to be that we can determine it to be true independently of experience. So something is a priori if and only if we can determine it to be true without looking at the world, without checking, without searching around, without hunting under the table or sending rockets into the sky or checking what's going on Mars. It just doesn't matter. If it's a priori, I can do it by reflection or thought in some way. And then conversely, so the a priori refers to the mechanism, right, of how we evaluate it, and we can evaluate something as a priori if something can be a priori if we can evaluate it independently of experience. If it's dependent on experience, then that's a posteriori. Okay, so this is the last time that we got toward the end to analytic and synthetic. All this building up to this bizarre notion of synthetic a priori. And analytic and synthetic describes not the way in which we know propositions, but they are types of propositions or judgments, not how they're validated. And Kant will say that analytic propositions are explicative. While synthetic propositions are amplitude. So, when something is an analytic, if we construe the judgment in such a way that the predicate of the judgment adds nothing to the concept of the subject. It is merely taking the subject proposition S, whatever S is, and breaking it up, analyzing it, right? So that the predicate is contained in the subject, is Kant's phrase, and that we come to this by merely examining the subject concept. So because, again, now let's think about the obvious thing, since we don't have to look at the world in order to do this, right? Then if we're just analyzing a concept, then it will follow that we can know, analytic judgments can be known a priori. Now, last time I said that concepts were immediate marks for a determination of an object. So to say that a judgment is analytic is to say that the predicate is a mark contained in the subject proposition. So just to give it a little formality, we'll say that if a concept is a concept is nothing but a set of marks, right? So the concept apple is got, what marks does an apple have in it? It's not a trick question. What are the marks of an apple? It's a fruit. What else?
Red or green.
Yeah, it's red or green. It's going to be more or less round, right? Red, green, fruit are the marks. So this is apple, right? And then it's constitutive of the concept apple, and it's marked out by the further concepts, which are also marks, of fruit, you know, colored in a certain way, roundish, right, and so on, grows, all that. All that's contained in the subject proposition. So predicates are marks of marks. That's the technical jargon. Kant's other way of talking about analytic propositions is to say that a proposition is analytic if its denial involves one in a self-contradiction. So, if I say this is an apple and it is not a piece of fruit, then, right, by various substitutions, we can say that we're saying something both is and is not a piece of fruit. So, it involves one in a contradiction. Again, without even looking at the object, I don't have to, as it were, examine it. That's just built into the idea of an apple. So we have two different, and Kant likes them both, notions of analyticity, namely containment, and the denial involves a contradiction. A synthetic judgment is one which adds to the concept of the subject a predicate which has not been in any wise, quote Kant here, in any wise thought in it, and which no analysis could possibly extract from it. So the idea is a synthetic judgment. He has subject. He has predicate. Let's keep it as apple. But now we're going to say the predicate is, how about ripe? No examination of the concept apple will tell us whether an apple is ripe or not. In order to do that, we have to actually, we're making a claim, not about the concept, but about an object in the world. Therefore, we're making a claim about a third thing. Third things come up a lot in Kant. And the X is the third thing. And this is the beginning of Kant's concept of judgment, because one of the things he's claiming here is that a judgment is more than an association of two impressions or an ideas, right? Again, if you're an empiricist, you would simply have an apple impression and a ripeness impression, and they'd be associated with one another, but without any question about how they were connected. For Kant, in order for a judgment to be synthetic, it's claiming that the object picked out by the subject term has the property, that's what that is, has the property, right, this is the is of predication, has the property picked out by the predicate term. So X's, third things, tend to be in Kant intuitions. So synthetic knowledge is knowledge in which concepts determine an intuition. That's going to be enough. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if there's different scales of analytic or synthetic, because an apple, for example, has the potential of being ripe or non-ripe.
Right.
So that makes sense, but to say that it's walking or it's happy or not happy, or walking or not walking, or so on and so forth, doesn't adhere to the concept of apple. So I'm just wondering how that would work out in this kind of schema.
You tell me.
I would say that to say that it's walking or not walking maybe is contradictory analytically.
It's going to end up, it's going to take a long detour.
Yeah.
But it's going to end up as an analytic judgment, because it's just going to be the kind of predicate which cannot be said of that kind of subject. But it's going to take detours. And that's the other thing, is that lots of analytic judgments are not obviously analytic judgments, because you can't get there quickly. As it were, to get the contradiction, you have to have a lot of propositions. Which means that, which is why the notion of containment can be tricky, right? Containment makes it look as if it's just a matter of investigating rather than, as you're suggesting quite rightly, complex inferential analysis. Yeah?
After synthetic judgment has occurred, does that particular proposition then also have an analytic status? In the sense that once I've combined predicate that was not originally thought within the subject, it's now been synthesized. In principle, I should be able to then derive from that synthetic judgment the predicates that I previously synthesized. So in the sense that all analysis or analyticity presupposes a prior synthesis.
Well, that may or may not be true. I'm not going to bite on that, but I'll do the converse. And the converse is, I can transform this into an analytic judgment, and I can transform it because it's a material extension. That is, it has to refer to the third thing, right? This is why Kantian synthetic judgments cannot be rerouted into analytic judgments. Now, we'll come back to your problem when we come back to the Quine problem, which is what you're... I take it that was the intention. Yeah, all right. But we'll come to the Quine problem. Okay, so we've got... These are really just crude, but the point I want to get is that synthetic judgments are material extensions of the subject concept. And by material extension, I mean, again, everything was on the right-hand side here. It refers to the matter, the sense, right? So that it really adds to what we do. We have to check out the world. So a judgment, then, I'll just give you a quick definition, is a relation between a subject and a predicate, which is not merely an association of their ideas, but an assertion. And those of you who've done Frege can now understand why Frege suddenly thought he needed an assertion sign. But never mind. Frege saw that there was something more involved in a judgment, and he wanted to get it through the notion of assertion. And what we're doing is, it's an assertion that the connection between the subject and predicate terms holds in the object denoted by the subject term. And therefore, there must be some third thing between them, between the subject and the predicate, which Kant calls X, and to which S and P and synthetic judgment are related, and through which they are related to one another. That is, they are related to one another through their being related to the third thing. Again, remember, intuitions are immediate representations of things. Okay, this said, therefore, we might suppose, and this is what all the rationalists and all the empiricists suppose, given everything I've said, it seems rational to suppose that all synthetic propositions must be known only a posteriori, and all analytic propositions are known a priori, and the only propositions that we can know a priori are analytic propositions. And that just follows from this barrage of definitions I've given you. So Kant wants to say, he's going to write an 800-page book in which he's going to say, there's another possibility. And he's going to claim there is a possibility of there being synthetic propositions that we can know a priori synthetic propositions. Which is to say, they're going to be propositions which have a material extension, but that we can know a priori. That have a third thing, and yet we can know it a priori. Which is to say, there are contentful propositions, propositions about intuitions, which can be necessarily and universally true and cannot be falsified. And isn't that just the sort of thing that philosophers get excited about to hear? If we could have knowledge of the world, material extension of our knowledge, not just moving around with concepts, but real material extension of our knowledge, and it be universal and necessarily true. We can do it, you know, a priori. That would be a kicker. Yeah, there was a question. Yeah.
Regarding the judgment on, say, the apple or the fruit,
yep.
Would Kant call that empirically analytical or a priori analytical?
Well, again, you know, this is a Quine question again. He would, on the containment analysis, anything that's analytic is a priori. Because, again, just so long as, and you're asking the question, how do we get there? And I'm resisting answering the question for the moment. But roughly, if I can know some truth just by closing my eyes and thinking of it about the apple, so whatever I can know about apples that I can do by lying in bed on a Sunday morning, we're going to call that a priori.
Even if what I know about apples is derived from sense experience. I only know that, right.
Well, we have to distinguish as Kant says famously that while all knowledge derives from experience, trivially, there's going to be no knowledge that we haven't got by our interactions with the world. Not all knowledge depends on experience for its truth. And it's the notion of depending that's the crucial thing here, not deriving. Joe?
I just want to be clear on the vocabulary. So are we saying a synthetic a priori judgment is one, it's a concept without an intuition?
No.
So what's the intuitive content to an operate? Okay.
Well, it's going to take us at least 2-3 weeks. I'm going to hint at it today. Okay. I'm going to tell you today, but maybe in the next hour. But that's the puzzle. What's the X? Right? What's the magical X? Well, let's just first of all ask ourselves, do we think there are any propositions that might be synthetic a priori? And let's not worry about all the details of the particular reason. Kant, in the reading, in the introduction, says this is synthetic a priori. What do you think of that? Why does Kant say that, and why might you agree or disagree with it? Yeah?
One might initially disagree because they think it's analytic, because if you analyze the number, then you will arrive at
Yeah, he thinks the 12 is a material extension. Why does he think that?
Yeah?
I think, and let me try, that's right, he thinks at least on the containment I can make it easy. Because 12, we're just too used to it. But how about if I do this? 7 plus 5 equals m minus n. Well, we can imagine an infinite number of placeholders for m and n, and indeed a numbers that no one has ever thought of as those placeholders. So at the very least, it's the case that the notion 7 plus 5 equals whatever it equals is not right, contained in these two concepts. Right? Is that example clear? Am I just giving you more math than you ever wanted? Okay, so that would just be contained. Yeah?
There's also there's something he calls pure intuition that I'm wondering about, because he says that this involves a certain intuition, so there's a certain process and there's a certain intuition, but in the large schema you associated intuition with sense, and I'm wondering what's the place of pure intuition.
I will come to it. I mean, that's obviously the magic thing. But, I mean, what I wanted to get at least here, is at least we can think that this is God. I mean, we're all agreeing that this is necessarily true, right? But I'm trying to convince you that it is synthetic. And on one ground of, analyticity, the containment, it fails. So it has to be synthetic on the containment theory. How about on the contradiction view? How are you all on your logicism and mathematics? Okay, well, it was... you might think that the denial that 7 plus 5 equals 12 will lead, or m minus n, it just doesn't matter, will lead to a contradiction. And that's what Frege and Russell and Whitehead thought, because they thought, and I want to be clear what they thought, because what they thought, if it's false, then it gives at least some legs to what Kant's thinking about. They thought that all of arithmetic, and this is what poor Whitehead slogged through, I mean, Whitehead did all the hard grind, right, in Principia Mathematica. Russell said, we'll do this, this, and this, and poor Whitehead slogged out the deductions. But the thought was that arithmetic could be cashed out purely in logical terms. That is, using just the terms of formal logic. The 108 axioms, whatever. 108 axioms of symbolic logic, we could get arithmetic, plus some extras. The objection to that, and we take another whole course in itself, but there are two standard objections to, let's call it the Russellian Leibnizian program. First, that at least some of their axioms are suspect. For example, they have what they call the axiom of infinity. And the axiom of infinity is meant to guarantee that there be an infinity of possible mathematical objects. Some of us might wonder, how on earth are you going to get that thought out of pure logic? That looks like a hefty extra thought. So first of all, it's not clear that all the axioms really are purely logical. But then, of course, the real killer for it was Gödel's theorem. And Gödel's theorem, his incompleteness theorem, simply states that there cannot be any finite and consistent set of axioms from which every mathematical truth can be derived. So that would help at least get going on the question of
I apologize. I'm definitely not convinced in this idea that this is a synthetic proposition. I was just thinking, let's say instead
but if it ain't logicism and it ain't containment,
what? Well, I mean, to me, the top statement, 7 plus 5 equals 12, is quite obviously an analytical judgment. Imagine if instead of 12 you had 1, and on the other side you had 0.5 plus 0.5. To me, that would be an obvious example of analyzing a single unit into two of its parts, 0.5 and 0.5, the same way that analyzing 12, you could analyze 12 into any of its parts and add them together and get 12. I mean, in my mind, 7 plus 5 is...
But that was what Whitehead was trying to do, right? I don't know if you ever take a look at the Principia, but, you know, it takes like about 80 pages to get 1 plus 1 equals 2, because he's really going to try to get there. Okay? It turns out you need all this apparatus on the label. So, of course, it can look as if, and this is why the Quine problem arises, it can look to us in retrospect that 12 is just what we mean by, but it turns out that at least formally, if we think about analytic judgments again in terms of containment and contradiction, it can't be cashed out. So something is or is not analytic may not be obvious. Take another proposition that Kant doesn't discuss, which is a bit more complicated. But I take it that we probably think that nothing can be red and green all over is both necessarily true, but I would want to argue that it's got to be synthetic. Why might one think otherwise? First of all, I mean, it isn't necessarily true, isn't it? I can't imagine a possible world in which something could be both red and green all over. The reason why I think it must be synthetic is because the way to make it analytic is red, by definition, is not green, not purple, not yellow, so on. So you just do it as a series of negations, and therefore you may say it is contradictory. But I don't think that will work. And the reason I think that won't work is because I think at some point in this... let's call it dictionary definition. I look up in the dictionary red, and it says whatever is not green, not yellow. Right? And I look up yellow, you know, what's the problem there? Why is that going to be unsatisfactory, my looping around negations in the dictionary? Well, but I'm saying, let's imagine we're doing that. That's what the dictionary is doing. It's telling us, you know, red by definition, and then it does nothing but negations of all the other colors. And then I check any other color, and it, right? Why? So that would be the analytic account of nothing can be red and green all over. And I'm saying that's unsatisfactory. Why would it be unsatisfactory?
But by knowing that it's not this and this and that, we still don't necessarily know what red is.
Good. I mean, at some point, I think you've got to have some version of an ostensive definition. This is red. That is, I think you have to go outside the series of concepts and bring in an individual. So we now have... I can see I really disturbed you. Yeah.
What about the proposition red is not green?
I think eventually it would come, since I'm suggesting that's what nothing can be red and green all over breaks down into, the series of negations. Then eventually, again, I think that's going to turn out to be not going to have to be synthetic a priori. Yeah, okay.
Can I just push that more? Could it, because I see why you would want to say that you need some external experience or intuition of a color, and then it'd be synthetic, a priori. But what if it was just color X, color Y, couldn't be both one and the same on covering? And you didn't specify, let me put it there, that's not clear. Let's say if you didn't specify an actual color that you needed an intuition of, but you had just something couldn't be color Y and color X all over, then would that be an analytic judgment?
No, because again, you'd have to, I mean, the same problem, because, well, it depends how you want to handle color. But colors are going to be, is going to be your term for what red and green have in common. You have to refer back to the colors. And just, there can't be a definition of color independent of colors. Let's go Aristotelian there. Okay, I'll let you ponder that, but I just wanted to loosen you up with the thought that maybe the notion of synthetic a priori is not purely crazy. That's all I wanted to get. Well, let's think about the case that really worried Kant, and it was Hume's argument, and there are two propositions that are connected. The first is the proposition of the causal maxim. What's the causal maxim? Anyone?
All effects must have causes.
Hmm?
All effects must have causes?
Yeah, necessarily. Everything that has a beginning has a cause. There is a second, so that's one notion of necessity. The second is that particular causes have or must have, let's do it this way, must necessarily have certain effects. That is, that there is a bond of necessity linking cause and effect. So if the cause is heating the water to 212 degrees Fahrenheit, then the effect is the water boiling, and the claim of classical causal theory is that if that happens, if that causal event happens, then necessarily the event's going to happen. Now, Hume discovered that at least B, or you can claim, and by the way, Kant doesn't ever exactly deny this claim, that B is false. And Hume did it, as we know, by just a bit of, you know, counterexample. That is, he just thought when I perceive the cause and I perceive the effect, I do not perceive, that is, there's no impression, idea or impression, of a necessary bond between them. Rather, all that happens is first I see one, then I see the other, and it so happens that usually, regularly, this is called the regularity theory of causality for a reason, regularly when I see A, I see B, and there's nothing more to it. There's no magical necessity, let's call that the glue of the universe. There's no magical glue holding causes and effects together. It was that demonstration that awoke Kant from his dogmatic slumber, or so he says in the Prolegomena. And what Hume further thinks is that if B is false, if not B, then, he thinks, not A. That is, he thinks if I can show, having shown that there's no necessitation, ontological necessity in the world, it follows that the causal maxim is not necessary. So, on page, right near the end of the book, A766, where he discusses it. Exactly that proposition, and I'll just read it from, skipping bits from the sentence, that sunlight, down the middle of the page. That sunlight should melt wax and yet also harden clay, no understanding, Hume pointed out, can discover from the concepts which we've previously possessed of these things, much less infer them according to a law. Our experience is able to teach us a law, blah, 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 if, however, wax, which was formerly hard, melts, I can know a priori that something must have preceded, upon which the melting has followed according to a fixed law, although a priori, independently of experience, I could not determine in any specific manner either the cause from the effect or the effect from the cause. Hume was therefore in error in inferring from the contingency of our determination, in accordance with the law, the contingency of the law itself. That's pretty much, by the way, the argument of the entire Critique of Pure Reason. So, what was Hume's argument in the treatise? Well, Hume's argument in the treatise was something like the following. On the board. Maybe, given this 5 episodes, let me get this on the board. Let's have a 5-minute break. It's getting hot in here. I'm hot. And you want to take a deep breath, and I'll kind of get this argument on the board, and then we'll discover something about synthetic a priori.